Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Right about now, maybe your junior in high school is eyeing his or her prospects for college, and it's time to think about that application essay, or maybe your junior in high school is just trying to pass English. Maybe it's your junior in college who's struggling, or maybe it's you. New York Times bestselling author and creator of the top-ranked Grammar Girl podcast, Mignon Fogarty, has written a new book for all of us, one you can hunker down with your kids to read at night and consult every day. Mignon is with us now by phone from her home in Reno, Nevada. Welcome to the show, Mignon.
I am. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, you know we love your questions and comments when it comes to grammar. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, we know when families get together over the holidays, there's always an argument about grammar that pops up at some point. If you want to anticipate that, give Mignon a call. She loves to solve the problems and side with you. This is a big, fat, hard-covered book, Mignon. You call it the ultimate writing guide for students. It seems very permanent, and I'm wondering about why ultimate.
Thank you. Well, I found that teachers were using my other books, but they weren't comprehensive enough or organized in the way that teachers would teach a class. And so when I was putting this book together, I wanted it to be the ultimate writing guide. I pulled together everything I knew and everything that was sort of scattered around in my other books and in my podcast and on the website and made it into it's not a textbook. It's
right.
Orange and it has cartoons and fun illustrations, but you know, something that's it's the most comprehensive book that I've put out. And I'm hearing from a lot of students and teachers that it's that it's really working for them, which is so rewarding. I just love hearing that. I just got a great email last night from a teacher who's using it. And then sometimes I think we may have limited it too much by calling it the ultimate writing guide for students, mm-hmm. because I hear from adults who are using it too.
Exactly. Well, I you know, everyone's a lifelong student if you think about it, right thing, the right way. Now, it's still very conversational, which if you go, I actually went online and looked at text from conventional textbooks, you know, the kind we grew up with, and there's a huge difference in just the tone of it.
Right. I mean, grammar can be so dry and dull and, you know, filled with rules. And I'm still grammar girl. You know, I still need to make it fun and interesting for people to read. So, you know, it's organized and you know, has everything there. It's very complete, but it still has that conversational style. You could read it. You could still read it through and find it relatively interesting.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's how I started reading it. And I thought, crap, I'm never going to get through this tonight. So I had to start jumping around, which is what I wanted to do right now. Let's start with the last chapter first. It's called Your Right to Write. Your R-I-G-H-T to R-I-T-E. Why that title and why is it the last chapter?
Well, it comes after the chapters that are more rules-based. So, you know, they have punctuation and word choice and parts of speech. But I've always felt that if students focus too much on the rules, it can actually inhibit their creativity and their writing. And writing is about so much more than just getting the rules right. And the sort of the premise of the book is that if especially for young people, if you want adults to take your ideas seriously, then you need to present them in a clear and serious way. And the only way to do that is to write properly. Well, I mean, unless you're in debate. But if you're writing, you need to write clearly to get your points across, and then adults will take you more seriously, which I think is what most young kids want. So Your Right to Write covers those things that can be forgotten. Like so many people, adults and kids, undermine their own writing by using qualifiers. They use words like kind of, almost, a little. You know, I'm a little upset about this new law. I'm kind of worried about what's going to happen in the future. You know, those kind of and pretty and little words, they undermine your arguments and your thoughts, and they make you seem like you're not quite as convicted in them. So, you know, so one of the sentences quash those qualifiers, and it talks about leaving words like that out when you can. Which you usually can.
My guest is Mignon Fogarty, grammar girl and author of Grammar Girl Presents, the ultimate writing guide for students. If you have a question or comment for Mignon, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. And you can tweet at Ann Fisher, WOSU, and hashtag Grammar Girl. And we'll try to get to your questions that way. 614-292-8513, though, if you want to speak with Mignon. So writing is a valued skill. You made that point already, but we're tested on it all the way through school now. But with the trend toward technical schools, writing skills are not taught or reinforced in some higher ed.
Right. And, you know, but before I was Grammar Girl, I made my living fixing
right.
writing from technical people.
They needed you badly. Or bad?
Right.
No, badly. Okay.
They needed me badly. And, you know, people who can write, no matter what position they're in, if you're a car mechanic or a computer repairman, it still, if you can clearly communicate in writing, you're going to be more valuable to your employer because, you know, there'll be fewer misunderstandings. And your email messages will, you know, be received happily and not, you know, grudgingly because someone has to decipher what you actually mean because your writing is so poor. And another thing people are surprised that I say in the final chapter of the book is, you know, is to forget about all these rules on your first draft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people say, what? Grammar Girl says forget about the rules? But, you know, again, some people feel oppressed by the idea that they could make so many mistakes in their writing, and they face that blank page or that blank screen, and they just can't write. And I think it's important to, you know, just let it flow, get your ideas down, but be sure you leave yourself enough time to go back then and look at your writing with a different eye and look for the mechanics of the writing, the things that you can fix to make it clear. But it's important to get your ideas down first, I believe, and then it's a whole different, I don't know for sure, I haven't done brain studies, but I believe it's a whole different part of your brain that, you know, helps you understand punctuation versus that helps you, you know, come up with creative ideas to get your points across. And if you can separate those tasks, you can do both of them better, I think.
The art of the writing is the art of the rewrite.
Yes, you have to leave yourself time. And I know it's hard because we're all rushing these days.
In chapter one, in the parts of speech, you said that your intent is practicality, noting that you're big on that and that you give batteries and socks for gifts. And besides being glad that we're not part of your family at the holidays.
I know.
What does practicality have to do with the English language?
Well, you know, there are some rules that are, you know, you can do it this way or you can do it that way. Let me think of an example.
Mm-hmm.
So the serial comma in the if you have a list of items like red comma, white comma, and blue, that last comma before the and is called the serial comma. And some style guides call for using it, and some say to leave it out or to only use it when it's necessary to avoid confusion. Well, you know, given that it's a style choice, you know, neither way of doing it is wrong. I recommend that people just use it all the time because that's simpler. So to me, that's the more practical choice because
mm-hmm.
you don't have to be analyzing every sentence to see, oh, am I causing confusion? Do I need it here? Do I not? You know, just use it every time. It's not wrong to do it, and it makes your life simpler. So
is the serial comma the same as what do they call the Oxford comma? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
614-292-8513. Give us a call if you have a question on grammar. For Grammar Girl, Mignon Fogarty, she's with us for the rest of the hour. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You refer to the dreaded apostrophe in Chapter 3. Why do you think people dread the apostrophe?
So many people get it wrong. And I had an epiphany maybe a year or two ago, and I think I know why people get it wrong, at least in the your, its, and whose cases. So, you know, it's drilled into our heads in grade school that apostrophes are for possessives. You know, it's when you show Anne's radio show, it would be Anne's with an apostrophe S yes, because it's possessive. It's your radio show.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like in our brains, apostrophe, possessive, but then it's not true for pronouns. Pronouns are completely different. So possessive pronouns don't have apostrophes. So if I'm saying your radio show, it's possessive, just like Anne's radio show, but it's the version of your without the apostrophe. So because apostrophes can also be used for contractions, your with an apostrophe is a contraction for you are. But we're so drilled to think of apostrophes going with possessives that we forget that that's not always the case.
You mentioned five books you'd rather not live without in the bibliography, and it made me think about the fact that a lot of folks don't even own any books on grammar or writing style. A lot of people don't even own a dictionary anymore. They just do it all online, and they just have the auto checks manage these things. To what extent do you think our reliance on those sorts of tools are weakening, you know, whatever side of the brain it is works in grammar?
Well, I mean, the online dictionary, I use online versions of dictionaries when I'm writing because
right.
they're right there on my computer. But, you know, I pay a fortune to subscribe to the Oxford English Dictionary and some of the more expensive ones. So they're not probably not the typical ones that the average person is using. But I know it was when I discovered usage guides and popular grammar books. When I was in college, like Patricia O'Connor's Woe Is I, you know, when I started discovering books like that mm-hmm. really talked about language and, you know, essentially the things I write about today, I mean, I'm not doing anything new. I'm just doing it, you know, in my own way. Mm-hmm. But it was the discovery that there were so many other people who were excited about language and cared about the rules and could present them in interesting ways that got me excited about language in a way that I hadn't been before. So, you know, I'm hopeful that people still discover my books or some of those other books and really realize just how fun and interesting language can be. And it, you know, I mean, so much of it, I mean, there are the rules, the hard and fast rules, like when you use a semicolon and things like that. Mm-hmm. But there are also so many interesting nuances and things that are style choices and rules you can break to make your point or, you know, like here's an example. So many people have been taught not to start a sentence with a conjunction. Like, you know, you should never start a sentence with and.
I do it all the time.
Yeah, and it's not a real rule.
Right.
No modern style guide says you can't do it, but a lot of people think you can't.
Mm-hmm.
So when you dig into the sort of deeper, not rules, but sort of the deeper discussion about the language, and you find that many of these harsh strictures you were taught aren't actually true, it sort of frees you up to write better and make your points and put punch into your writing. So I think it's important to explore. I think it's fun to explore the language.
My guest once again, Mignon Fogarty, Grammar Girl, author of a new book, Grammar Girl Presents the Ultimate Writing Guide for Students. We're going to take a break. When we return, we'll get to our emails. We'll get to our calls. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. There's very little waiting at this point, so don't wait. Thanks for listening. Well, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
NOVA takes viewers on a journey from the Galapagos Islands to the Arctic. From the explosion of animal forms a half billion years ago to research labs of today. Watch as scientists begin to crack nature's biggest secrets at the genetic level. On the 150th anniversary of Darwin's On the Origin of Species, NOVA reveals answers to the riddles that Darwin couldn't explain. Watch NOVA, What Darwin Never Knew. It's tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus, scattered showers today and a high of 58. Cloudy tonight, a low of 42. There's a 50% chance of rain on Thursday and a high of 51 degrees. Still a slight chance of rain Thursday night, a low of 36. And then cloudy by Friday, so hopefully no more rain and a high of 42. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Mignon Fogarty, grammar girl and author of Grammar Girl Presents, the ultimate writing guide for students. We've had Grammar Girl on many, many times now since I started the show almost 2 years ago. This is just about our two-year anniversary, as a matter of fact, Mignon.
Wow, congratulations.
Well, no, you've helped. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Robert. He writes, one of my pet peeves is that instead of writing a lot with a space between a and lot, people often write a lot as one word with no space.
I know, they do. It's such a common error, and I'm not sure why. There is a word that's pronounced like a lot that is one word. It's A-L-L-O-T. As, you know, in a sentence, it would be, you can allot the cookies to the students, you know, sort of distributing the cookies. But a lot, which means many, is two words. And I tell people the way to remember that is to think that when you have a lot of something, one word isn't enough to describe it, that you need two words because you have so many, or so much. So
that's
maybe that'll help.
But that feels like it's one of those words or phrases, I should say, that's falling into it's so many people are using it as one word now. It's like, you know, it's hard to argue with them.
You know, it's interesting because that is how language changes. Much as people hate it, language can change because so many people make a mistake that it becomes the most common way something is done. An example of that I've come across recently is the phrase begs the question. So I started writing about it intending to defend the traditional use, which is a term from formal logic that means someone's making a circular argument. But after spending 5 hours searching Google News for an accurate example of it being used and not being able to find one and seeing thousands and thousands of examples of begs the question being used wrong to mean, you know, raises the question, I decided it was a lost cause. I mean, much as I would have loved to fight for the original meaning, that battle has been lost. You know, much as I hate it, it's going to mean raises the question from now on, because that's how so many people are using it. But I don't think a lot without a space is there yet. I think it's still mostly perceived as an error, and I'm hopeful that we can continue to fight for that one.
Paul in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann, Mignon. I always love your grammar and word shows. And there's a word that I get it right 95% of the time, but then I read a lot. But you can see it misused frequently in news publications, things like that. And it is a genuinely conundrum. I mean, a really difficult thing. And that is the word sanction, because it is the same word, but it has two exactly opposite meanings. You know, for instance, the playoffs were sanctioned by the NBA. But the college athletic program was sanctioned because the coach did something bad.
Yeah.
That's the same word. And I just wonder if you have any guidelines for how to delineate the difference in terms of the way you structure. Well-read people will get it, but just your average person reading the newspaper could easily be very confused. Comments?
Right. You have to be careful. There are a set of words that are like that. They have opposite meanings, and they're sometimes called Janus words, after a Greek Roman god who was two-faced. And so a Janus word is sort of a two-faced word because it it has two completely opposite meanings. And there are a bunch of them. I'm trying to think.
What are some other examples?
Yeah, I wrote about them in the grammar devotional. I'm trying to remember. So let's see. How about to buckle? That you can buckle a belt, which is putting it together, but when something breaks apart, it can buckle too. You know, like the beam buckled and broke. Mm-hmm. So it can be to put together or to break. What's another one? Sanction is the most obvious one. Maybe... like weather. So to weather can mean to wear down, like the the bridge was weathered, meaning mm-hmm. the materials were worn away. But you can also weather a storm, which means to sort of survive, mm-hmm. to hold up during a storm. So there are a handful of these words called Janus words, or they have another name. I don't remember what it is. But, yeah, they're really interesting. And really what is important is making sure the context makes your meaning clear when you're using them in writing.
Thank you, Paul, for that call. We appreciate it. Sarah in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hi, Ann. Hi, Minion. This is Sarah Wager in Westerville.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. My question is about the dreaded apostrophe you were talking about earlier.
Yes.
And, you know, the very popular phrase now, girls' night out. You know, when I'm sending an email to my girlfriends about our girls' night out, you know, is it, you know, there's multiple girls. So
right.
is the apostrophe after the
it goes F? On the Yeah, it goes on the very end. So when you're making something that's already plural possessive, you just put the apostrophe on the end. So yeah, you are the girls. You are, you know, five girls.
Right.
Plural. And so then it's possessive of all the girls. So the apostrophe goes on the end.
Okay.
It's actually more complicated than that because
yes.
you could also it also wouldn't be wrong to write it without the apostrophe. It would be girls' night out, and then it sort of a more common example is farmer's market. Some people use the apostrophe, and some people use it as a modifying term to say what kind of market it is. Mm. So you can. With the apostrophe, it's sort of possessive. It's saying it's the market of the farmers.
Gotcha.
But if you don't use the apostrophe, it just becomes a modifier saying what kind of market it is. Sort of like if you're talking about a Christmas tree farm, a tree farm, tree just tells you what kind of farm it is.
Right.
So farmer's market just tells you it's what kind of market it is. So it's sort of a choice you have to make. It's one of those tricky things that's sort of interesting about language because it can be done properly both ways. But if you want to, probably the safest way is to put the apostrophe on the very end of girls.
Thanks.
Now,
yeah.
Now, also, my daughter, her name is Frances, ends with an S.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm talking, like, about Frances's book.
Yeah.
You know, is it S apostrophe S, or is it just... You know, the last S in her name and an apostrophe.
It's a very similar example because you can do it either way. Either way is
okay.
Correct. It's actually a style choice, which is so frustrating. There was a fascinating story where our Supreme Court justices actually argued about whether Kansas's statute should be Kansas with just an apostrophe on the end of Kansas, or it should be Kansas's with the apostrophe S on the end of Kansas, and the main opinion and the dissenting opinion, I know they have other names than that, but the two opinions spelled Kansas's differently because they couldn't agree. So you're not the only one who struggles with this question.
Thank you, Sarah in Westerville. And now we have Sarah in Dayton. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hi, I have a question about the use of myself. It seems like it's being overused instead of I or me. And I'm just wondering, is there a rule or is it just becoming common that everybody's going to say myself for everything?
She and myself went. I hear that a lot too, Sarah.
Yeah.
I do too. It's a strange one. I don't know why people do it.
I think it sounds more formal to people.
Oh.
But it's not.
Yeah, but it's not. Yeah. I guess it sounds more formal, but what I tell people is, to think about how you would say the sentence without the other people in it. So usually you would say, send the memo to me, send it to me. So if you add someone else, send it to Anne and me, it's still me. So it's usually, often, not always, but often I hear people use myself instead of me when they add someone else to the sentence, when there's a list of people, it'll be Anne Mignon and myself, whereas if they were just alone in the sentence, they'd get the right word. They'd say me. So it should be, you know, send the memo to me, send the memo to Anne and me. But yeah, and I don't know why people use myself in those kind of sentences, and they shouldn't.
So what's the grammatical distinction when you say I wrote it myself?
Oh, well, that is, so myself can be two things. It can be a reflexive pronoun, which is what I've been describing. It's when, if you've already mentioned yourself in the sentence and then you do it again, it, that's when you use myself. I got that wrong, but so when you use it for emphasis, when you say, I wrote the book myself, the myself doesn't change anything. I wrote the book means the same thing, but myself adds emphasis.
Okay.
And when it, and when you use it that way, it's called an intensive pronoun. So it, it has these two different roles, reflexive and intensive. And when it doesn't add anything to the sentence, when it's just creating extra emphasis, it's called an intensive pronoun.
Thanks a lot, Sarah. We appreciate your call.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Melissa in Grove City, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Hello, thank you. I just have a complaint about people using a pronoun, prepositions at the end of a sentence, such as the word at, where is my coat at, instead of where is my coat or where is my jacket. And another pet peeve I have is the word done, are you done? I was always taught that a chicken is done and a person is finished.
Okay. All right, let's hear from Mignon. Thanks, Melissa.
Sure, there are two things, actually. So about the preposition concept. So ending a sentence with a preposition isn't actually wrong. It's something a lot of people were taught, but the rules, the foundation of the rule is extremely shaky. It goes back to the 17th or 18th century, and the people who came up with it just kind of made it up. So, but it was taught widely in schools for many years, but there's no modern style guide that says it's wrong to end a sentence with a preposition. However, the kind of sentence the caller was talking about is sort of different because the preposition at the end is unnecessary. So if you're saying, where's my coat at? They mean the same thing. So the at is, it doesn't, it should, you should drop it because you don't need it. It's unnecessary. And that's what, it is one of those things where you're talking about so many people say it that it's sort of embedded in the language that where are you at is, you hear it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like you shouldn't do it in writing, but I'm afraid that this is a losing battle. I'm still fighting for it, but I'm worried about this one. So in general, it's not wrong to end a sentence with a preposition, but those specific kind of questions, where's your coat at, you really should leave it off because it's just redundant and unnecessary. And then this done versus finished thing, that we should definitely talk about because it comes up at Christmas dinner. You know, people, someone will say, I'm done, and then Aunt Betty will say, you're not done, you're finished, the turkey was done.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there's very little basis for that rule. I just wrote about this for my next book that's coming out and did some research, and you really can't find a good reason that you shouldn't say done. So it's sort of, I'm pretty sure that if I'm thinking of the right rule, that some style guides even call it a fetish. It's just something that bothers people, but it's not really wrong. So, you know, you can try to control your blood pressure when your niece says she's done.
Okay, let's get to a couple of those emails, and then we'll get you their calls. Once again, folks, I'm talking with Mignon Fogarty, Grammar Girl. We've spoken many times before, author of a new book now, Grammar Girl Presents the Ultimate Writing Guide for Students. And as my associate producer just mentioned, gosh, you're a book writing machine, Mignon. Email from a listener. I recently got a needs improvement on a work evaluation because I had poor writing skills. I'm a business analyst. I've never been a good writer. Had to take the freshman college writing class over 3 times. How do I learn to get better? Would your book help, or is there another book? Gosh.
Well, I mean, I hope my book would help.
Yeah.
You know, also, I would say, you know, it sounds as if the writer is sort of stressed about this and probably busy and doesn't have a lot of time. You know, there are two things. It would be good to have a reference book on hand where, I'm sorry, was it a man or a woman?
It just said listener. I don't
know.
Genderless.
Okay, so where the listener could, you know, look things up when, he or she is writing and has a question, isn't sure about something. So you can use those online dictionaries. You can have a reference book like the Ultimate Writing Guide handy to look things up if you have a question. But there are probably two things, like trying to expose yourself to good, solid writing just by reading a lot, like reading edited publications, you know, like the New York Times or The Economist, or, you know, something that is sort of really high-level, well-written, edited stuff. And then you'll sort of pick up the way things are said. That's one thing. And then, you know, the other thing that he or she might try is just listening to my podcast, which you can get on iTunes or anywhere else you get podcasts. It's free, and it's short. It's 5 to 8 minutes. It comes out once a week. And the whole idea behind the podcast was for people like the listener who, you know, are having trouble writing at work and just need a refresher on all the little rules. And so it's a quick, easy way. You know, the listener could listen while commuting to work or doing the dishes or doing the laundry or something. And it's sort of a fun, easy way to absorb ideas about writing, as opposed to sitting down and trying to study with a book, which, you know, will work great for some people but may not work as well for others. And for some reason, just from the way that email was written, I'm thinking maybe that won't work for this person. So, you know, have the reference book handy, look things up when you need them, but maybe, you know, try the podcast as a way to sort of work it into your life on a regular basis in an easy, light way that doesn't seem so oppressive.
One thing I will say about the listener's email is I think they do a good job at keeping their ideas short. And you do talk about wordiness. And, you know, I mean, sometimes if you don't, I was going to ask a question about the wordiness issue, because I've edited grad students' theses. They've asked me to read them over, you know, because my background's in writing. And a lot of times it's like, gosh, it's so clunky. And I say, why do you have to use this kind of tortured language? And they say, well, if we don't, we get marked down. They don't like it if you're too brief, if you're too to the point.
Yeah, it's a particularly a challenge in government and the sciences. You know, there's this idea that you have to use a lot of words or big words or complicated words to seem important or smart.
Mm-hmm.
I know in government there's a movement toward using more plain language so that laws and regulations are more understandable for the common person. And it's a real battle. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's by no means certain to, you know, win, but there are people who are trying to fight that trend and make it okay for people in those situations to write in just a more clear, concise, understandable way.
We have an email from David. It's just a comment, but it's interesting. He says, I was recently involved in a minor car accident, and I was very impressed that the police officer wrote a clear and concise explanation of the event in his report. I was especially impressed because he made it clear that the accident was not my fault. Writing clearly is very important. And that's a great example of somebody whose job is maybe not, you know, maybe writing isn't part of the qualifications, but
it is. Yeah, another place is user manuals. You know, you're so grateful when you get a user manual or assembly instructions for furniture that are just clear, that just make it clear what you should do. And so often it isn't the case, and you wonder if, you know, who wrote that.
Well, I wonder if it's even written by somebody who really understands English, or it was from a program that's supposed to just translate into English. Because sometimes it's in English, but it's like very awkward and doesn't make any sense. So my guest, once again, Mignon Fogarty, Grammar Girl. We'll get to those calls. We'll get to some more emails when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Anthony Shadid, the New York Times Beirut bureau chief. For the past year, Shadid has been reporting on the Arab uprisings in Egypt, Libya, Syria, Bahrain, and Tunisia. In Libya, he was captured with three other journalists and beaten by Colonel Gaddafi's forces. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Time is running out for you to make your 2011 contribution to our station. Our goal is to raise an additional $50,000 by December 31st. Pledge at WOSU.org/2011 or by phone at 866-897-9678. Happy holidays and Happy New Year from WOSU Public Media. And thanks for your support. And join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow at 10 a.m. Holiday cooking and holiday food ideas. That discussion begins at 10 in the second hour of All Sides tomorrow. A discussion of holiday events in and around Central Ohio and First Night Columbus, a New Year's celebration. Join us for All Sides tomorrow from 10 until noon. Scattered showers this afternoon with a high of 58 degrees. Cloudy tonight, a low of 42. There's still a 50% chance of rain for Thursday, a high of 51, and then a very slight chance of rain looking ahead to Friday, a high of 42. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is grammar girl Mignon Fogarty. She has a new book out. It's called Grammar Girl Presents the Ultimate Writing Guide for Students. Question or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Kate in Victorian Village, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm really enjoying today's show.
Thank you.
I've done a lot of writing, from legal writing to blogging and, you know, just sort of creative writing. But I encountered something very interesting when I was working on my master's in theological studies. We were taught that, you know, with respect to the possessive apostrophe in a name that ends with an S, for Jesus, we would put the apostrophe after the S and leave off the extra S, if you will. But with all other names, like Judas's, you know, Judas's choice would have that extra S. And I thought that was such a neat sort of, like, industry kind of way of highlighting the understood, you know, divine nature of Jesus by making, you know, crafting the things that were, as to say, the things that were his or even described, you know, in this unique way. And I was wondering, you know, if Grammar Girl has had, you know, kind of, you know, if you've had other encounters of this, you know, in technical writing or in writing at the graduate level that's specific to perhaps government or, you know, the social sciences. I thought that was the neatest thing.
Yeah, there are. The rule is that for Jesus, you never use the extra S on the end to make it possessive. And it's true for a few other classical names. I don't remember offhand what they are, but I want to say maybe Moses. Also, you leave it off. And then there's some names of maybe Greek gods or Roman gods where it's also done that way. So there are a handful of what I remember reading is that they were called, you know, classical names or something mm-hmm. like that. So there are a handful of names of, you know, famous classical people where you never use that extra apostrophe S. And I thought it was fascinating too when I ran across it. So thanks for bringing it up.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Take care. Let's see. I'm going to Tom. Tom, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Hi.
My question is this. Would I say none of these people is qualified or none of these people are qualified? I always have a problem with that.
Yeah, you're not alone. It's one of those tricky things. I was writing about it for my next book, which isn't out yet, but it's called 101 Troublesome Words, because there are these really difficult questions like none. And the thing with none is that none can mean not one or not any. And when it means not one, it's singular. And when it means not any, it's plural. So you sort of have to make a choice. If I remember right, if you can't decide or you're struggling, the safest choice is to treat it as singular. So you would say not one of them is sure what to write. it's one of those things that you kind of can't get it wrong, because you could argue either way that you mean not one or not any, and it's really vague. So it can go either way. But if I remember correctly, the safer choice is to treat it as singular, but it's actually not wrong to treat it as plural.
Thank you, Tom.
That's a big help. Thank you.
You bet.
And it's a horrible kind of answer, the kind of answer that makes people crazy. I know.
Yeah, because they want you to say what's right. But here's an email from Carl. This word's been brought up before. They all bear repeating. One rule I get confused is the difference between toward and towards. Any input?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a little bit easier. It has to do with the difference between American and British English. And in American English, we drop the S. We say toward, go toward the dog kennel. And the way I remember that is the same with backward. In Britain, they'll use backwards sometimes. They'll use towards sometimes in British English. And I just remember that Americans like shortcuts. You know, we like drive-through windows. We like to eat our food in our car. So we like shorter things. So we like the shorter word without the S when it comes to toward.
Stephanie in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Hi. I do a lot of writing. And one of the words that I have to use quite frequently because of the type of job that I have is tardiness. And in terms of absenteeism and tardiness. And so one of the things that I really get tripped up on is figuring out the plural for tardiness. I don't know whether to say late. I don't know whether to say tardy. Tardy seems really wrong. So I don't know what the plural is for tardiness.
Let's see. So you would say, tardiness is a problem at our workplace. You could say John was tardy 4 times last month. I think when I was in school, I remember hearing them referred to as tardies. You know,
mm-hmm.
John had
yeah.
four tardies this month. But it does seem sort of informal. I don't think it's necessarily wrong. You could look it up. I just keep
tripping over this and try because what and I wind up having to use it within the context of describing how many times a person has been absent and tardy, and so and describing it. So I can't always get out of it by saying, okay, so and so has, you know, tardiness is a problem or what have you. Like you were saying, I will run into it when I have a situation where a person has been tardy. You know, if I'm saying that Jane accumulated 50, and that's when you come in, okay, tardy, I mean, is it tardy, you know, 50
you know
tardy.
Unless you're getting pushback from someone, unless someone is complaining, I would use tardies. I mean, it doesn't seem wrong to me.
Okay, Stephanie?
I hate that word, so thanks.
Well,
okay. Sorry.
Okay. Take care, Stephanie.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
I can't think of a better word.
Yeah, well, or just rephrase it and just say so-and-so has been late 6 times.
Yeah. Yeah, you could write around it, but if you have
to
use a plural, then I actually do think tardies is probably the right
mm-hmm.
choice.
Email from Mike. I am curious about the origin and correctness of a little as an adverbial phrase, specifically a modifier of an adjective. Could you comment? A little in quotation marks.
Like saying it's a little yellow?
Yeah, I guess adverbial, yeah. Well, it's a little late. It's a little slow, an adverbial.
Yeah, that seems fine to me. English has a lot of words that can mean lots of different things. And sometimes people will get hung up on one particular meaning, like maybe he's thinking little means physically small
mm-hmm.
and is wondering how it can be applied to an abstract concept like yellow or late. But there are a lot of words that are very flexible in their meaning. And, you know, you look in the dictionary and there will be 36 different meanings for a particular word, and it can be 4 different parts of speech. So, I mean, it's not uncommon for words to have lots of different meanings like that. I think that's what he's asking, if that's what he's asking.
Before I want to take a call from Doug in Worthington, but we're going to try to get the folks who are on the line right now. I'm going to work really hard to get to you, so don't despair. Doug in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann, and hello, Minion. Listen, there's something that bothers me as much as combining the words a and lot to make them one word, and that is the abbreviation of the word until to till. I To me, till, T-I-L-L, is a money box, and T-I-L isn't a word yet. I think people, if they're going to say till, they ought to spell it apostrophe T-I-L. But that isn't happening yet, and I'm wondering if we can start a national movement.
You know what? That is really fascinating, because a lot of people agree with you, but it's not backed up by the word's history. So till, T-I-L-L, is actually an older word than until. It came first. And until came later, and till with an apostrophe, apostrophe T-I-L, is actually the least sort of etymologically accurate version of the word. I forget what the exact words are, but Merriam-Webster definitely, in their discussion, says that, you know, till with an apostrophe is not correct. So, but you're not alone. I mean, until about probably 5 or 6 years ago, I thought the same way you did. I thought T-I-L-L was wrong until with the apostrophe was right. But when you look into the word's history, it's really fascinating, and we were both wrong.
Isn't that
I have to go over it.
That's really interesting. Thanks, Doug, for that call.
Thank you. Thanks.
Mary in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering what your opinion is on the way people use quote unquote when they're speaking, because it was always my understanding that you would say quote when you were starting to make the quote, and then unquote when you had finished making the quote. For example, if you were quoting Shakespeare, you would say quote to be or not to be, unquote. But now I've noticed that people most commonly say quote unquote before they've even started to quote.
Hmm.
So what's your opinion on that?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I thought you were going to say that it should be quote, end quote.
Yeah.
Because I've been getting some pushback on that. But, no, you're right. You should say quote when you start the quotation and unquote when you end the quotation. I guess I have heard people say quote, unquote, before a very short
or very famous.
Or a very famous quotation. But it's, and I guess the meaning is probably clear, but it's not. The more common and I think accurate way to do it is to have the unquote at the end of the quotation, because then any listener will know when you're finishing that quotation. You know, obviously, to be or not to be is so famous, everyone would know when it was done. But but yeah, the right way to do it is quote at the beginning, unquote at the end. I have had people believe that unquote is wrong and that you should say end quote. But for whatever reason, unquote is the right term to use in that instance.
Okay, Mary, thanks for that call. Robert in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I always enjoy and learn from these programs.
Thank you.
I have a pet peeve, and I've observed this as 40 years as an academic and grading a lot of papers, et cetera. The historical present is seen to be used more and more. For instance, for something that happened completely in the past, like Mr. Lincoln goes to the theater and gets shot. First of all, why is there so much use of this historical present, and should I get upset over it? Let me tell you my policy. I told students, okay, you can talk to me like that, but don't put it in your term paper or dissertation or thesis. In formal language, we shouldn't use that. So I'd like your comments.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, no one's ever asked me that before, but it would bother me too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it happened in the past, you know, it just makes sense that you would use the past tense. I've actually noticed in fiction there's a trend toward using the present tense in books. Right now I'm reading The Night Circus, and it's written in the present tense, which I'm enjoying the book, but I find the tense a little odd. And I was talking to an MFA student maybe a year or two ago, and he said it sort of is a trend that's happening in fiction. So maybe that's where your students have, I mean, you've said this has been over 40 years, but maybe more recently students have been picking it up from fiction. But I think it's a reasonable rule that they have to use the past tense in writing, and if they want to speak a certain way, they can. But you're the instructor. You get to say.
You're the boss, Robert. Thanks for that call, Robert. Ed in Newark, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Hi. I just hit a spot of static as you spoke. I'm concerned. I'm an NPR addict. I find myself shouting at the radio regularly over the commentators on the air use of snuck and everyone's misuse of number and amount.
Mm. You don't like the word snark?
Yes. I'm going to have to give up the ship on that one because it's sneaked, of course, but everyone uses snuck now.
Yeah, snuck versus sneaked.
I misheard you. I thought you were saying snark.
Yeah.
Snuck. Okay, snuck for sneak. You know, that is another fascinating case because in English, verbs tend to regularize over time, which means that we add ed to make them past tense. So the regular past tense of to sneak is sneaked. And normally language evolution would strongly favor moving in that direction toward a regular verb. But for some reason, with sneak, snuck is the past tense. The irregular past tense is gaining ground rapidly.
Yes.
I mean, I read something like, 10,000 new Americans every month are switching from sneaked to snuck or something like that. I mean, it's a huge number of people are changing. It's really big. And you can see, if you do a Google book search, you can see that snuck is increasing its appearance in published works. It's a real trend. And I'm not really sure why. I don't think I've read anything that ever adequately explained why that irregular verb is so popular.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm afraid it's a losing battle, but I still tell people that sneaked is the safer choice, the better choice.
Thank you, Ed, for that call. I just want to get to a couple emails if we can squeeze them in. One's from Ruth. She says, I have a coworker who believes that the following sentences are correct as written. She was unhappy the rule changed. Employees shall document they have worked. I, on the other hand, believe that each of them needs a that as follows. She was unhappy that the rule changed. Employees shall document that they have worked. Thoughts, Mignon?
Boy, the first ones don't seem wrong to me. They really don't. But I hesitate to say absolutely. I'm not 100% certain, so I don't want to get in the middle of a workplace argument I wouldn't want to do that without doing some research. But my inclination is that the initial sentences are okay.
And I had an editor once who thought that we don't use enough that's and that they're for clarification and that they make things clearer. But I don't know either. I don't know the answer to that. This email from Joseph: I grade college writing, and I've started noticing that many students using the phrase based off of when I expect them to use based on. Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, there are instances like that. I've seen that, and prepositions are often interchangeable and switch around. I don't know about that particular example, but, we say something happened on purpose, and now people are starting to say things happened on accident instead of by mm-hmm. accident. So we're switching from on accident to by accident or vice versa. So there, prepositions can change. You know, in most of the country, people will say they're standing in line, but in some places back east, people say they're standing online. Prepositions are really slippery.
They dangle, they switch, they slip, they do all kinds of things. Mignon Fogarty, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. Have a great holiday.
Thank you. You as well. And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.